Remembrance Sunday marks the centenary of the armistice, which brought to an end World War I after 4 years of devastating conflict. It was a defining moment for all Australians and also for a newly established Commonwealth Bank. In this podcast, we look at the bank's contribution to the war effort, including staff who served on the front line, and the 26 who made the ultimate sacrifice, never to return home. Chapter 1, Those Who Went to War. 417,000 Australians served in the First World War. Of those, nearly 60,000 never made it home. Just 2 years in operation, the Commonwealth Bank saw 241 of its people sign up to serve their country. That was equal to the bank's entire workforce at the start of the war. Young men and women eventually made up the staff shortfall during the war. Of all the states, it was Tasmania which contributed most per capita, with 35% of its men serving between 1914 and 1918. Among those was Branch Superintendent Ernest Hilmer Smith. At age 36, he was one of the oldest CBA men to serve. He joined the 12th Battalion with fellow Tasmanian colleagues Vivian Cyril Brooke and John Chambers. As commanding officer, he saw action in Gallipoli, France and Belgium. News of the heavy casualties and wounded servicemen eventually reached Australia. In France on New Year's Day 1917, Smith wrote to his boss, the governor of the Commonwealth Bank, Denison Miller, painting a vivid and bleak picture of the battlefield.
The country in which we're located is laid waste by war. Not a village or tree remains standing, and the ground is one mass of holes caused by high explosive shells for miles and miles. These holes are really dangerous, especially if one is out in the dark, as being full of slimy mud, too often a depth of 6 foot, it is a difficult matter to get out of after once getting in. Good fortune and providence have so far watched over me, and I have escaped other than slight injuries. The conditions of living here are extremely hard, but better than Gallipoli. The worst thing we have to contend with is mud. This is literally over our knees in most places, and one wants to be in the pink of condition to travel far in it. The organisation is splendid, and everything works well, but the life is too strenuous for a man to hope to last very long at it. The weather conditions are trying. Rain, frost, and snow prevail, but our fellows are standing it remarkably well. It is astonishing what men will go through and yet remain cheerful. We have now been for 5 weeks without our clothes off once, but beyond rather a tired look on their faces, the men are as full of spirit as ever.
Lieutenant Colonel Smith survived the war and returned to Australia and the bank, subsequently being promoted to Superintendent of New South Wales. As for Smith's branch colleagues, Vivian Cyril Brooke died on the battlefield in Gallipoli. After the war, John Chambers eventually returned to the bank. Another of our men, 24-year-old Reginald Atkinson, a clerk from our Adelaide branch, joined up in September 1915 with his first campaign in Egypt. On his journey there, he dropped a message in a bottle overboard, and weeks later, it was found along the southwestern coast of WA. The note, which he asked to be sent to his mother, was brief.
Farewell, Australia. All well and happy. Gunner RCO Atkinson, Australian Field Artillery.
Atkinson was another survivor, and after his discharge from the army in 1920, he returned to the bank's Adelaide office. And finally, 22-year-old Arthur Henry Cobby, known as Harry, a clerk from our Melbourne branch, went off to war with the AIF for 2 years. He survived and came home as Australia's most celebrated flying ace, having shot down 29 enemy aircraft and earning him some of the highest aerial honours, the Distinguished Flying Cross and Distinguished Service Order. Sadly, 26 men from the Commonwealth Bank didn't return from the war. Among them was Private Colin Robertson of Shepparton Branch, killed at Gallipoli, and Lieutenant Ronald Henderson from Wagga Branch, who died on the Western Front. They are both buried in a foreign field far away from home, but never to be forgotten. Chapter 2, Financing the War. As the war went on month after month with appalling loss of life, the financial costs continued to grow. Australia entered the war with a public debt of £333 million, £230 million of which was raised on the London financial markets. Early estimates put Australia's cost of financing the war at £40 million, but this proved to be far too low. London couldn't meet the eventual demands to raise £250 million, so the Australian government turned to the Commonwealth Bank to come up with new ways to plug the gap. Under Governor Dennison Miller, CBA took the lead in organising and managing all of Australia's war loans through a central war loan committee. These fundraising efforts, which included the release of 10 bonds through public subscriptions, resulted in a huge amount of work for staff, already stretched due to enlistments. Bernice Pitcher, who joined CBA in 1916, described the pressure associated with the paperwork.
When war loans were being issued at short intervals, we worked night after night till 10 o'clock for months. The dining room was opened and we were served a meal for sixpence.
To entice people into purchasing bonds, military equipment such as tanks were used at public meetings to draw the crowd and show how the money was to be spent. A full-size replica of a Navy destroyer was set up outside the Money Box building in Martin Place with a large sign that read, "Save and Serve, Buy a War Loan Bond." When the war ended, the financial pressures facing the country did not let up, with three peace loans raised, the last of which was named the Diggers Loan. The proceeds of this used to cover repatriation costs, including the construction of homes for returned soldiers. In a relatively short time, CBA had established itself as the government's banker. Governor Dennison Miller later recalled,
"When the bank first started, we started in a very small way, and then the war came on. We were faced with the position of having to step into the breach and to practically control the finances of Australia, which we did."
With hard currency in short supply and the need to pay for munitions, amongst other things, the bank was called upon to organise a number of urgent and secret shipments of gold on the government's behalf. Preparation and packing of the precious metal for shipment happened overnight. On one such occasion, a load of 1 million sovereigns, each worth $945 in today's money, was carried down the Swan River in Perth in small boats by bank staff under naval escort, and later transferred to a larger ship destined for London. Sometimes these shipments were suspended or abandoned because of enemy naval threats. Chapter 3, The Home Front. Keeping the bank operating smoothly and efficiently throughout the war was a huge challenge for Governor Dennison Miller, given so many experienced male staff had enlisted. As the government's banker, CBA was responsible for the payment of 400,000 servicemen and women based in countries such as England, France, Greece, Turkey, and the Middle East, as well as Australia. Nationally, CBA continued to expand, going from 14 branches at the outbreak of war to 36 by November 1918. CBA's answer to the manpower drain was to recruit more women and teenage boys of school-leaving age. Women in particular proved to be well-suited to banking. The number of women on staff in 1914 was 21. The number grew to 582 by 1918, making up 40% of the entire CBA workforce. At the time, Governor Dennison Miller said,
"As the war progressed and the need for the men to go to the front was so apparent, I would not take on to the staff of the bank any men of military age. By taking on boys and taking on girls, we were able to carry on a fast increasing business.
Our London branch, which had around 200 clerks, most of them women, worked on soldiers' accounts, largely payments to widows and those on war pensions. At one stage, the London office was processing 3,000 transactions per day." Back home, Mile McCourt of the Secretary Department head office spoke of the efforts of one junior male colleague whose job it was to ensure the mail delivery from Sydney to London made it to the ship on time. Mile recounted two stories about the young man.
On finding the mail had gone when he reached the general post office, he dashed off to catch the ship before it sailed, found the wharf gates closed but climbed them and placed the bank's London packet into the care of the purser. On another occasion, he even chased the ship up the harbour in a launch. A line was cast down with a bag on the end and the bank's mail was hauled aboard.
The female staffers put in extra effort on the home front, helping raise funds for charities and other support groups, as well as making up comfort parcels for their CBA colleagues serving in the armed forces. Staff were also able to make voluntary contributions through salary deductions each payday. By 1919, about 200 CBA staff had returned from military service and rejoined the bank. In the years to follow, 500 veterans were recruited for the expansion of CBA. Among the new recruits, Sister Elizabeth Murrell, who at the age of 37 served in Greece with the Australian Army Nursing Service, treating the sick and injured. Her reputation and war experience quickly endeared her to the bank's staff, including the governor, who spoke of her during a speech in 1920.
"We have another soldier with us tonight. Sister Murrell came on to our staff to do special work, and we are pleased to have her with us."
Her service to the bank was to last another 20 years. Chapter 4, The War's End. On the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, the guns fell silent. The war was over with the official signing of the armistice. By 9 p.m. that night, thousands had flocked to the streets of our major capital cities to celebrate. In Martin Place, Sydney, the crowd so large that movement between Pitt and George Streets was almost impossible. Similar scenes occurring in Melbourne and Brisbane. Of the 417,000 Australians who enlisted during the war, nearly 60,000 were killed, and a further 150,000 wounded. With a population of fewer than 5 million, hardly anyone remained untouched by the horrors of the war. In tribute to CBA's fallen and those who served, a roll of honour was unveiled by Denison Miller in Martin Place, June 28, 1919, the day the Treaty of Versailles was signed, officially ending the war with Germany. Addressing the head office staff, he spoke of our war dead.
"Of those names you see on the roll, the first place of honour must be given to those who made the supreme sacrifice. They gave their all, their lives that humanity might live. We mourn their loss, and their heartfelt sympathy is tendered to their mothers, fathers, and other relatives."
Some of those attending the ceremony would have been well aware the governor was also speaking of himself having lost his son, Lieutenant Clive Lancelot Miller. The Gallipoli veteran was killed in action in Messines, Belgium, at just 28 years. Ever stoical, Denison Miller spoke little publicly of his own family loss. Lieutenant Miller's name can be found in the commemorative area of the Australian War Memorial in Canberra, along with those 26 CBA men whose deaths were felt just as keenly by the man they called Governor. On Sunday, November 11, we'll again pay tribute to our fallen, exactly 100 years after the guns fell silent. They never returned, but they will never be forgotten.
"They shall grow not old, as we that are left grow old.
Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn.
At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them.